WMFO.
You know what I realized just now?
What's
is
that?
I did not allot any time for That's the Thing That Happened.
It's true.
So we're working out the bugs.
Yeah.
Save your thing that happened for next week. I'm going to save mine.
It's a pretty good one. It's worth the wait.
Mine's great. It's Christmas themed. And
it's
kind of a shame not to get to it now, but you know, we're branching out. We're doing the new thing. Talking about the movies.
The movies.
Shea Spillane, film degree. What year did you graduate?
2008.
Shea Spillane, 2008, film degree, Fordham University.
Mm-hmm.
Derek Gary, film degree, 1991, Boston University. Both avid film goers. I've been a film critic. I have owned a film, run a film magazine. I've been on every possible side of a camera. Shay has been on most, I think, every possible side of a camera.
Pretty
yourself,
much, yeah.
Actually. So we know our way around this stuff.
Yeah.
We know what we're talking about.
Not our
about.
First rodeo.
Start off, did you see anything this past week?
I did, actually.
What did you check out?
I saw Just Mercy on Monday.
I want to see that movie. Tell me.
Oh, my God.
Do I want to see that movie?
See that
is a better question.
See that movie so hard. I will say I always enjoy a movie when it touches every emotion. You know, like you hear people talk about things like I laughed, I cried. This is very much I laughed, I cried. There were times I will say that it's definitely I knew it was going to be a powerful movie. I didn't know how powerful. Like I'm a very respectful moviegoer. Save occasionally putting my feet up on the seat in front of me if it's not going to disturb anybody. I'm 6 feet tall, guys. I got to get comf. But this, I will say, multiple times over the course of this movie was the most difficulty I've ever had not screaming at the screen.
Hmm.
Like, not just lashing out in anger. Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx just, I mean, perfection.
I think the story here is Jamie Foxx has been wrongfully convicted of murder, sent to death row. Michael B. Jordan is the young lawyer who's working the case pro bono,
yeah.
Isn't he?
So basically, and this is not a spoiler, so don't worry, but so basically, Michael B. Jordan gets, he's at Harvard Law School, and he gets inspired by an experience that he has while in law school interning that makes him propose to the government to start a fund to help prisoners on death row in Alabama who may have been wrongfully accused, maybe didn't get a fair trial, all of that. So it's a government grant, but you think about comparing it to some of the salaries that other people who graduate from Harvard Law School start
with.
That's
pro bono work.
Yeah, it may as well be pro bono work. But it's just, I mean, I'm always a big fan of the based on a true story films. It really brought out the main reason that I really enjoy films that are based on a true story, which is that it hits you that much harder emotionally when you know this isn't just something somebody made up. Like, this actually happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I know, you know, things are dramatized, things are added, things are taken away, but they do a very good job of sticking really well to the original story. And even something that I think a lot of times gets lost on films that are based on a true story is a lot of times they'll kind of cancel out like people who maybe were significant to the overall story but don't really aren't necessarily like needed for the plot.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't do that. It makes sure, and which I think is really a victory in terms of how this film goes, because it does give you, I mean, it just adds to the whole this really happened feeling. It's like you can see that people are kind of side characters, but they are really important to just giving you an overall picture of the situation. Like, you know, that the movie could have just zoomed in just on Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx, but it really did. I mean, that was definitely the central focal point of the movie, but it made sure to make sure you knew, like, well, this wasn't the only thing that was happening, though. But yeah, I mean, I saw it with my cousin on Monday night, And like, it really, we ended up, we're walking down the street. We saw it at the AMC Common. So we saw it right downtown. And it led to like a very interesting racial discussion. Walking along, coming back to our cars.
That's always a good thing when you walk out of that, you know, when you walk out of the theater and you're motivated to have that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely...
And I don't think anybody walked out of, you know, as much as it got the accolades last year, I don't think anyone walked out of Green Book and said, hey, let's talk about racism.
You know? Like this definitely, I mean, it really, like, I mean, and I think that it was very timely in terms like the release of this film. And I'm sure that when they released it in terms of the date was, you know, intentional, but that it was released right before Martin Luther King Day, that it was made in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, it really does. I had a conversation with one of my good friends about race and about, you know, being a white person trying to understand, never really being able to. And it really, I mean, you're not going to leave this movie understanding what it's like to be a black person if you're a white person. That's just, nothing's going to make that happen.
Yeah,
but it does, it makes it realer than someone just telling you what it's like. You know what I mean? There are lots of, and I'm not going to say them because I don't want to spoil the film, but there are lots of just like really subtle details and slap you in the face details that make you just stop and go, wow, like it's absurd, but that's so real. But, and that's so, and this, the thing is like the whole time too that I was watching it, and my cousin agreed, my cousin's 3 years younger than me. So she was born in 1989. I was born in 1986. And for those of you who don't know, this movie takes place like between the late 80s, it goes over the course of the late 80s and the early 90s. And her and I are walking out of the theater saying, this wasn't like 50 years ago. This happened while we were alive.
Yeah.
Like this is recent. Like this is not things were crazy back then. This is within what I would call the present, you know? I mean, the 90s were not that long ago. I can remember them.
There's one of the things that jumps out of the trailer, and I think you just spoke to it and spoke to it very eloquently, is when you see Jamie Foxx's character, there is a resignation about him that I've been convicted, I'm going to die, there's nothing that I can do. That's just the way that it is. And it's good to know that the film gives you all of the sort of subtext around that mm-hmm. that would lead an innocent man, to sit there and say, I'm going to die. And again, the fact that it is our lifetimes.
Yeah.
That this still, because...
This isn't like my grandfather telling me about something.
A lot of people want to sit around and be like, oh, post-racial world. And it's like, it depends on where you are. And even then, under the best circumstances, no.
Yeah. Like maybe it's a... Well, and even, I mean, like I said, we got into a big discussion as we were leaving. And it was interesting to my cousin was saying, you know, we had a friend visiting Boston who was, a lot of you know that my best friend was one of the contestants on The Voice last year.
Right.
And one of the other contestants came to visit and like did a couple, like lended his voice to a couple of their gigs for a few songs. But he was out, and you have to realize too, he was out in Faneuil Hall. So Faneuil Hall, think about who's there on a Friday night.
Yeah, tourists and frat boys.
But he, you know, appeared to be having a good time. And then when they were leaving, he was like, I hate it here. This place is so racist. And Heather said to me, she's like, and do you think that's true? She's like, because I was like, he looked like he was having a good time. I was like kind of surprised to hear it come out of his mouth. But then I realized like, I'm not really in a place to like, I don't know what it's like. And I said, you know, it is interesting coming out of a movie that takes place in the very recent past in Alabama, because no, I don't think we're like that, but it is the way I described it in Boston is it's like a low hum that's always there. It's like you don't always notice the hum. The hum isn't always allowed, isn't typically a loud noise as it is in the South. But there is, I can say there's definitely some like underlying, it's less punch you in the face and more like kind of give you the side eye.
I think depending on where you are and who you're with.
Definitely true.
It is going to have a profound impact. There are some parts of the Boston area that are much more open-minded than others.
Yeah.
One of the things that's always sort of shocked me, you know, living on the North Shore is, you know, when we were growing up, I don't remember there being much overt racism from my generation. There certainly was from the older generations, but I don't remember seeing it as much from my generation. And, you know, in the years since my generation has become homeowners, I've experienced more of it. And I'm like, where did this come from? You know, we grew up with black friends. We grew up with mixed race friends. And I was saying, oh, black people are moving into town. And it's like, who cares?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's good. We want more working people living in our community because they will propel our community forward. I am looking forward to seeing that, and
it's, you know, like I said, I mean,
it's on my short list.
Well, it's funny because I actually wanted. I still have to see Knives Out. I think I told you I was supposed to see it with my dad. Dad, if you're listening, I'm still angry at you.
Somerville Theater, and they've still got the Cats. If you haven't seen the Cats yet, they still have the Cats.
Well, I want to see it on an AMC because I have a movie pass.
Yeah.
But my cousin was like, no, like, I really want to see Just Mercy. And I was like, all right, I was planning on seeing it, but I wasn't like, oh, I have to see this immediately.
Yeah.
But like, seriously, guys, go see this immediately.
Snubbed.
It's very, very good.
On the snub list.
Snubbed?
Yeah, for the Oscars. We'll get to that in a second. My film for this week.
Oh, yeah, it was, wasn't it?
My film for this week was 1917, which is Sam Mendes' World War I film. Presented in one continuous shot from the very beginning of the film all the way to the end of the film.
So it's one tracking shot?
It
never
is
cuts?
One tracking shot. There are no edits.
Wow. That's, I mean, just thinking about the precision that takes.
Yes.
I mean, if you think about, well, because the, so they just blew Goodfellas right out of the water.
The
then.
Way that they made the film, there's their documentaries are starting to pop up on YouTube about how they made the film. And at one point, there is a shot that you've seen in the trailers for this film, where one of our protagonists is running along the front line as people are coming out of the trench.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about how they did this particular shot. So what they have is they've rigged up this camera. And it's stabilized, and it's in this sort of metal wire frame with handles on either side. So they start out this shot with the camera on a crane that follows him down the trench and then is high enough so that it can follow him as he climbs up and out of the trench. Once it gets to the top of the trench, two people grab the camera on either side and move it over to a rig attached to a pickup truck so that the pickup truck can drive forward as the actor runs toward it. The two people who pick up the camera and move it are dressed in World War I soldier garb so that after the truck goes by, they can just run into the shot and be more of the soldiers running across. That's just one shot in this film. And everything that went into pull it is a monumental achievement. Roger Deakins did the cinematography for this. Roger Deakins was nominated for tons of things. He, for those of you who recall, he did Skyfall.
Mm.
He won for Blade Runner 2049. I am somewhat certain he's going to win again for this.
Yeah.
Most of the,
I mean, that's astounding.
There are moments in this film where you sit there and you say, how did they do that? How is the camera moving like this and these things are happening? And in some cases they used drones, and in some cases they used cranes, and in some cases there is someone, you know, with a new type of Steadicam, just walking ahead of the actors. The story, I think, is going to be lost on American audiences. There's a title card at the end of the film in which Sam Mendes thanks his grandfather for the stories. And clearly the script has been written out of several stories that he had heard about what happened during World War I. So the basic story is, you've seen it if you've seen the trailer, two soldiers are told to cross no man's land to get from trench A to trench B to stop a planned assault because they believe, the people in the other trench believe the Germans are retreating. In fact, the Germans have set a trap. And the brother of one of our protagonists is in the second trench.
Yeah.
So they've got to get across no man's land. They've got basically 12 hours to do it. There is a time compression thing that happens sort of organically through the movie so that we're not watching all 12 hours. But we're basically watching the two of them as they walk through all of this.
Yeah.
The production design in this film is unlike anything that you've ever seen before. It is not a huge blood and guts film, but there are bodies everywhere. And the destruction of the war, because the Germans... So
it's like you see what you would normally see in a war movie, you see the aftermath of it.
Basically. You're seeing the way that the war has ground up the countryside.
Yeah.
You know, and you go through a forest where all the trees have been blown up and cut down. And you go to a farmhouse that has been destroyed. And you go through a small village that has been reduced to rubble. And all of these, you know, these are immersive environments where every possible detail has been thought of. There is one scene in the film where one of our protagonists is in a river. And to get out of the river, he has to climb over the bodies of the dead that have just sort of accumulated in front of this tree branch. And they've gone as far as to have the varying states of decomposition represented.
Ooh.
Some of these bodies are far more bloated than the others. And those who know the history know those are the ones that have been there for a few days versus the ones that are fresh.
Yeah, versus the ones that died 6 hours ago.
That is the level of detail that is here. Now, the story itself is simply about duty. And as I say, I think it's lost on an American audience because that is a very strong English concept.
Mm.
We can understand the one character going to save his brother. We can't understand why the other character is there unless you...
Unless you understand the concept of duty.
Unless you're fully grounded in why what Meghan Markle and Harry are doing is thoroughly wrong and thoroughly horrifying to the English.
To the English, yeah.
It is about duty. It is about your responsibility to yourself.
Side note, I love all of the Yoko references that they make with Meghan Markle.
Your responsibility to yourself is secondary to your responsibility to society and to your fellow man. That is what it means to be British. It's an alien concept in America where it's me, 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 me all the time.
Yeah.
If you go back to the World War II generation, they had that sense of duty about them.
Mm.
But we've watched that get chipped away, you know, as our government has brought us into increasingly futile and needless international conflicts.
Yeah. Well, it really gets lost when the reason for the war is muddled.
Yes.
Like, I mean, in World War II, it was pretty damn clear why each side was fighting.
Yeah.
Same
thing in World War I. You know, it's the Germans again.
Yeah.
You know, it's always the Germans.
Well, and I think, too, those wars were about the good of the people, not the good of a couple of people. Like, you know, all these wars about oil, it's like, okay, well, yeah, all these 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old dudes are going over to fight for what? The interests of like 5-6-year-old men in suits? Like, whereas the two world wars, it was literally defending your country's people, like as a whole.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that sense of duty was definitely very much alive in that regard. I mean, that's why if you think about how America, even though it was, I'm better with World War II than World War I, I will say. So I'm just going to use that analogy.
As are most people in the world today. So don't feel bad about that.
But America, you think about it, for those of you who are like familiar with America's involvement in World War II, they kind of quietly had the Allies back for a good chunk of it, but were not actively participating. When our military started actively participating in the war was after Pearl Harbor was bombed, because that was a representation of, okay, now you're coming after our people, after our, like, that was what made us officially join the World War, World War II. And that, it, like I said, it was a representation of our country, of our people as a whole.
Both our Navy and our Air Force were engaged with the Germans prior to Pearl Harbor. Mm. Our Navy was trying to keep the submarines at bay so the shipping lanes would remain open. And our Air Force, we had a number of people based in the United Kingdom who were trying to defend the United Kingdom once the Nazis got into France.
I was going to say, it was like, that's the thing. We had much of more of a defensive and supportive role than an active, aggressive role before Pearl Harbor.
Not for lack of our allies asking, but for us saying...
really? This isn't our fight.
You deal with the Germans. Your problem.
Yeah, like, we'll maybe like help you out with some stuff, but...
We'll profit off of it, but we're not going to go do the thing. One of the main reasons that I could tell you to go see 1917, and I think you should, I think anyone should, is because this is a movie made to be seen in theaters. As I mentioned, the production design, I think this film is a mortal lock.
I think we're going to have to see it now after you talking about this.
I think this film is a mortal lock.
I was on the fence because I'm not a war movie person.
To win Best Production Design. Because the detail in it is extraordinary. But you have to see that in the theater. You have to experience in the theater and allow yourself to be fully immersed in it. There are rich details in every single shot of the film. And every single shot of the film is gorgeous. And there's a lot of complex, you know, hidden edits and computer melding and things that go on to make it one continuous shot. But Deakins is in top form here. The whole point of this movie is to sit there in a dark theater and see it on the largest screen possible. Mm. And this is where the movies have to go. Now that we live in this world of streaming, we have to ask that question, which I brought up in the past, of is it cinema if we're watching it at home on Netflix? We don't have an answer for that. And I don't think there is a cut and dry answer for that. But I think there is a very clear cut and dry answer for what is cinema in a movie theater that demands to be seen on the big screen. Mm. And this is one of those films. So, you know, if you try and watch it on your phone, if you try and watch it at home, it's not going to be the same thing, because when you're in that theater and you're not distracted and you're not getting up, that's when this film can really work its magic. And it's worth the experience, because you will walk out of it. You may not walk out of it, you know, feeling that you've learned a lot about the human condition, but you will walk out of it understanding the absolute destruction of World War I.
I was going to say, now I'm going down to my mom's house to do laundry, not because I'm millennial, but because I am fiscally savvy and not going to pay $3 to do one load in my building when I can do it for free at my mother's house. But I'm looking up, she lives in Hingham, and I'm looking up, okay, well, laundry takes like, it'll be on, I could go to, there's an AMC in the Hingham shipyard.
There you go.
Like, I could sneak on over there for a little while.
Highly recommended. Oscar nominations are out.
Yes.
I could talk about what should have been. What are your thoughts? Outside of the Oscars so white, Oscar nonsense from people who don't understand anything about movies.
I am also surprised that Just Mercy was not tossed in this ring.
I think that's a huge, and I think it's a problem that people simply didn't see it. I hope it's a problem that people simply didn't see it.
I mean, because literally it's not represented at all. I will say that, like, looking at this, there are some particularly that, like, I think are very political in reasoning for being on this list. Like, you know, they're trying to figure out how to incorporate, like, Netflix and things like that into this. They don't want to anger certain directors who, you know, it's always very interesting to see what, because, you know, a lot of it is very political, and you have to think that it is people in the Academy who are deciding these things. But I will say, I mean, I think that it's, as Derek was just talking about, it's kind of, it's basically 1917 already has Best Picture in the bag, probably Best Cinematography too. I do definitely think the same thing about Joaquin Phoenix winning for Joker, because I mean, his role, whenever it's actor in a leading role, yes, I definitely think that it has to do with the actor themselves, obviously,
and he's how good their he's immortal luck.
I would say, and how good their performance is. But a lot of times when I look at, like, actor in a leading role, actress in a leading role, it's the character. And the character in that it should always be this very dynamic, very, like, this is going to be a pain in the ass to act character, and then an actor that pulls it off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's very rare. There can be an actor who gives an amazing performance and deserves an award, but if it's just with, I mean, that's the reason that, like, Tom Hanks winning for Forrest Gump. Like, it's things like that where it's like a Sean Penn, I believe, won for I Am Sam. It's when it's a character that's so difficult to play and the actor pulls it off. I mean, for those of you who saw Joker, I think that you would agree with me that, I mean, that was a very layered, incredibly layered character.
Yeah.
And really, the range of emotions that had to be so perfectly balanced and touched upon.
I have a checklist for, you know, whether or not someone is going to win the best actor. And I've got to dig it up and get into the specifics of it again, because I don't have there's 5 points to it. And the more points that you get, the more likely you're going to win the Oscar. Mm. Joaquin Phoenix, I believe, is 4 out of 5. And the only actor that's even close.
Yeah.
My problem with Joker is that it is... I don't want to be overly cruel to it, but it really is, you know, low-rent Scorsese homage. And as good as what...
That's you not being overly cruel.
I could say worse things about it. I do sort of like it, and I think the moments in the film that work incredibly well. The problem is the moments... The film as a whole... We have this brilliant performance by Joaquin Phoenix that anchors everything. But the structure of the film and the storytelling never turn up the heat under that character. And I'm looking for that moment when he finally, you know, has no choice but to snap. You know, because when we meet that character, his whole life is about keeping it together. Well, where is the moment in that film? Where have we turned up the heat sufficiently?
The moment is very clear.
It's not, though.
The subway.
It's not.
I disagree.
Because we've got to, if you go from the subway immediately into another series of events, then yes, but it doesn't do that. We spend another 40 minutes sort of futzing around in his life after that.
Futzing's a funny word.
You know, and there's one scene after that where he's talking to the detectives outside the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That is the moment where I'm sitting there and I'm saying, ah, now is when we're going to start turning up the heat on the character. And then it just fades out again. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, where did you learn how to structure a film?
Well, but I think that was intentional, in that this film was very careful to, even though obviously he loses it obviously.
Yes.
But this film was very intentional in keeping him from ever just being a crazy person. You know what I mean? Like, I think the scene you're talking about with him talking to the cops, it was very intentional that he's like, my mom's in the hospital right now. Like, yeah. I don't have time for this. Like, I think that was on purpose because it wanted to show that, yeah, he did lose it. Like, the subway scene, he lost it. But he didn't just go on a blind killing spree. He didn't just completely flip
right.
out.
And that's, it was, and it, that's fine. But what happens to his mother happens to her as a result of that. And that's where things start to escalate. And that's where I'm like, okay, now we're finally going to push this character to the point where he completely snaps. Everything is on the table. Anything is possible. And it doesn't. It rolls back from there and gives us another half an hour of, you know, exposition. And if you look at the way the story is structured, that should have been the things that happened in the movie. That should have been the moment where it all went off the rails. Instead, it's ultimately him being insulted by another character. Granted, a character that he admires
yeah.
and wants to emulate. But his poor treatment at the hands of that character, which, by the way, happens while he's in the hospital room with his mother. If you go from that to the end of the movie, I'm sold. It works. It's brilliant. They don't. They go into a half an hour of, well, I'm going to carefully think about this and plot my revenge and come on.
Well, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
I can see what you're saying. I still think that was deliberate. I still think it was to show that he hadn't just straight up lost his mind. Like, it was deliberate because it wanted to show that he was being deliberate. That it wasn't... The parallels with the parallels which people made a lot when this film came out with the timeline and the making of a mass shooter, I think is very much alive in exactly what you're describing, where it's like, I mean, think back to like Columbine, like Dylan Klebold went to his prom like a week before Columbine. I think it really spoke to making it very realistic in the very deliberate cranking of this as opposed to just a big, all right, everything's going to explode.
And it is about that. The film is about that, but it is more about a character who is dealing with a character who is living with mental illness, who is a functional, productive member of society, but by virtue of his otherness, is treated very poorly by our society. Mm. And finds it impossible to get any of the help that someone like you or I would take for granted in a similar situation.
Yeah.
You know, his mental illness renders him poor. His poverty renders him outside of the scope of what we as a society would care about. And there is a lot of that being said in the background of this film. And those are things that work. And I think that may play into the nomination. There's also a part of me that just says this film was nominated by the Academy and by the members of the Academy as a middle finger to everyone in the critical community, all the people in the commentariat, all the pundits who were sitting around saying, how dare you make this movie? And that this is Hollywood saying, you know what? We've spent the last 5 years listening to you. None of it has worked.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're doing. This is what we're going to make, and this is what we're going to celebrate. And if you don't like it, take a long walk off the Santa Monica Pier. I think there's a certain element of that to this.
Well, and that's what I was saying about that, because you have to remember that it is the Academy, so it's the people, it's the movie people who yeah. are deciding these.
Good, because there is a very big disconnect between the number of nominations that this film has received and the way that the film has been received.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it's interesting as people who know this world to look at it as, well, yeah, there are some things that it's exactly what these awards are there for. Like 1917 being nominated for Best Picture. Nothing political about that.
No.
It's just a movie that deserves to be nominated for Best Picture.
And when you see it, Shay, you will sit there and you'll be like, oh yeah, that should have been nominated. That's a good call.
But with that in mind, the way that the Academy Awards work is it's used as a way to send a message, a way to show respect, a way to, there's lots of deliberate thought. I have the word deliberate stuck in my head now. But there's lots of very meticulous thought that goes into what gets nominated. And it's not always, this is the best one. You know, it's not always this is what should potentially win.
There is a bigger,
a lot of times there is so much else that goes into it.
There is a bigger conversation about that I want to have, but I want to put that off to next week. Because we are gearing up for it. Believe it or not, our Oscars prediction show is going to be at the end of this month because Oscars are so early.
Yeah.
So I want to put that conversation off for a minute. And I want to talk about some of the other things that I think absolutely deserved nominations that didn't get them. The fact that Uncut Gems was overlooked.
I was going to say Uncut Gems. Adam Sandler was very eloquent about that.
Even if you want to punish Adam Sandler for all of his high crimes against filmmaking.
I actually read something the other day. It was called Adam Sandler's movies listed from worst to, okay, this is kind of tolerable.
Yeah. If you want to punish Adam Sandler and say, you know what, you're not getting the Oscar because you made that, fine. I can live with that. But don't take it out on the Safdie brothers, who directed one of the most high-energy dramas anyone has ever seen, a film that I walked away from and said, this is the future. At least give them a Best Original Screenplay nomination. At least acknowledge that. Because none of that exists without that brilliant script.
Well, and that's precisely what I'm talking about, is that if it was all just about the art itself, there'd be a nod. But this is a very much, we don't want to nominate an Adam Sandler movie, because that's where it's coming from. It's them. It's the same thing about, it's just like how Family Guy's never won an Emmy. They don't like Seth MacFarlane.
Right. Well, they love Seth MacFarlane, but they don't like the show.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, they don't like his show.
They're like, we're going to withhold awards from you until you decide to be serious.
Yeah.
And then you do something serious, and they're like, we're going to withhold awards from you because of the bad things you did in the past.
Yeah.
Go do more serious stuff, and we'll catch up to you.
Well, I love, too, that I know we're talking movies, but this is just such an adorable side note. I'm one of those people, like, I don't like watch Family Guy every week, but if in the mood for something silly, I'll because the whole series is on Hulu, I'll just binge watch little couples of it. But for those of you who haven't been keeping up with it in recent seasons, I actually just watched this recently. They actually have a show that addresses that they've never won an Emmy, and they basically, it's them jokingly doing a bunch of plot lines where they're like, can we win an Emmy now? And at the end, the episode ends with everyone just explaining why Family Guy can never win an Emmy. And it's really, I mean, I'm glad they take it in stride, but but that's the nature of what we're dealing with here with Uncut Gems, is it's not because Uncut Gems doesn't deserve an Oscar nod. It's because the Academy doesn't want to validate Adam Sandler. That's really the truth in all of this.
The other major snub I'm going to point out, Greta Gerwig. Have you seen the Little Women yet?
No, I have not.
I did not. I'm not a unabashed fan of that movie.
I would say I didn't see it mainly because I don't know why they had to do another one when the 90s one was so good.
This is the problem. This is part of the problem, is when you remake a classic that soon. And 25 years is short in Hollywood.
Yeah,
especially with a version as beloved as that version is.
I was going to say,
you know, there's a reason. I mean,
Winona Ryder is perfection, and that's her being her best Winona self.
Guadagnino got all kinds of heat for remaking Suspiria, and that was 40 years later. Greta Gerwig took big risks in the way that she did Little Women. She made it as a biopic. And you can make an argument as to whether it is a biopic of Louisa May Alcott or it is a biopic of the book. And there's some cues in the film that suggest it may be a biopic of the book. Okay. And that I'm not, that as a director, Gerwig is sitting there and saying, I'm not going to say this is what Louisa May Alcott's life was, but this is what we have, and maybe it is.
This is me using what I have to make an assumption.
So she restructures the entire movie to serve that, and it works. And it's a very interesting take, and it's a bold choice. And it's a well-made film with great performances. I think a little bit too heavy in montage in certain areas. And there's some fourth wall breaking at the end of it that absolutely irritated me because it comes from nowhere with everything else that we've seen. Unless you look at it and say, this is a biopic. And now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of this is a biopic. Well, you probably should have set that up before the final reel. I think the choices that she made are bold enough and the film is inventive enough that you at least ought to give her the nomination. You don't have to give her the award for it, but at least acknowledge that a filmmaker has done a fairly remarkable job taking a story that everyone knows and presenting it in a new and modern way.
I would say, and especially because, like I said, a lot of times the wins are very rarely a political move or a symbolic gesture. But that's what the nominations are there for. The nominations are there for you to say, like, there's always several things nominated that you're like, this is never going to win. But there's a reason they say it's an honor just to be nominated.
Right.
Because it is. And the Academy knows that. They know that even if, like, I'm sure that a lot of directors, actors, so on and so forth, they get nominated, know that they're not going to win. Like, the minute they get the nomination, they're like, all right, that was nice. Like, it was literally just them being like, it's nice they acknowledged I did a good job. Like, that's what that is. Like, there are plenty of things on this list, as I look at it, that it's like, this person knows they're, like, Margot Robbie knows she's not going to win Best Supporting Actress for Bombshell.
And by the way, I will say Anna Paquin probably should have got a Supporting Actress nomination. And there is no particular reason why Scarlett Johansson needs two of them.
Yeah.
Because what Anna Paquin does in The Irishman, and of course that's been derided by people who don't understand what they're talking about. Well, she doesn't have enough dialogue. There's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And the performance that she gives is central to the story.
I would say, I mean, there have been people who have won Best Supporting where they're really like a D character.
Yeah.
It's just that what their character does is so important that, you know, it doesn't matter.
I believe that Judi Dench has an Oscar somewhere in her home for 8 lines. In Shakespeare in Love. So
that's what I was going to say. It depends upon, Judi Dench is like barely in Shakespeare in Love, but she does such a perfectly effective job.
You know, when you understand what that character is that Anna Paquin plays and what that character is going through, it's an amazing performance, but it's one that in the midst of a 3-hour movie is unfortunately going to get lost a bit. But if you're going to throw out, you know, if you're going to add in Greta Gerwig, the question, of course, becomes, well, who do you throw out? You know, and, you know, I'll blaspheme and say, listen, you can easily get rid of Martin Scorsese because he's won that Oscar already.
Yeah. I have something that threw me a little bit, and I want to see if you can shed some light on this. Actor in a supporting role, Tom Hanks for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Yeah.
Is that because they have to have Joaquin Phoenix win in a leading role, so they wanted to put Tom somewhere else? Or, because I mean,
he's a supporting character. Have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't.
Don't. I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated
it. How is he a supporting character? It's about Mr. Rogers, and he's Mr. Rogers.
It's not.
Oh.
That's one of the big bait and switch things with this movie.
That's what I was going to say, because like you Google, what do you call it? You Google Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, everything that comes up is pictures of Tom Hanks in a cardigan.
Yeah, because that was what the marketing was. But that's not, he is not the lead character in the film.
Interesting.
And this is and one of those.
That's what I figured you'd be able to shed light on that for me, because I looked at it and was just like, what?
The film is based on one of these.
It's bait and switch. I love that you call it that.
The film is based on one of these journalist diary books.
Oh, so.
Which is, you know, look at how I was able to
so
overcome.
Is Lloyd Vogel the main character?
Look at how I was able to overcome the challenges in my life with the help of, you know, this other person. And the other person in this case happens to be Mr. Rogers. It is a terrible form of journalism created by unreliable narrators who are inevitably self-aggrandizing and exaggerating. And the movie is not. I know plenty of it. My wife loved it. And the easiest way I know of to get punched in the face at a cocktail party is for me to express my opinion on this film. That won't happen here because it's just,
you and me. It's just you and me, and we respect each other's.
But I'm going to tell you two things about it. Number one, I did not like the film at all. Number two, it is probably the worst Tom Hanks performance I have ever seen.
Ooh, burn. That is a deep cut, dude.
Tom Hanks. And this shows, there are a couple of brief moments where you're not aware of it. Tom Hanks is never comfortable in the role. And if you have ever acted, or if you know anything about acting and you know what to look for, you can see it in his performance. He never reaches a level of comfort with this character. He is terrified every moment he's in front of the camera, and it shows.
I can see that because I'm thinking about it. I don't believe that Tom Hanks has ever played a real person.
He did in Apollo 13.
Oh, that's true. But still.
But that was.
But that's. I was going to say, let's put it this way. A real person that everyone is so very, very aware of what they're like.
Right.
Like Mr. Rogers, you know, everyone, like both of us could whip out a crappy but valid enough impression of Mr. Rogers right now. Now I want to see it just to see if I agree with it.
As I was watching the film, all I could think about was Philip Seymour Hoffman in, the Scientology movie. I forget the founder.
I miss him.
Or the father. And that's not what they were going for here. You know, they make Mr. Rogers out to be some sort of weird cult figure. And if you saw the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, you know that he was nothing at all like that. You know, Fred Rogers was one of the most earnest and genuine people ever to walk the planet. Mm. And what we have here is a bunch of cynics saying, well, you know, that can't be true. There must be something else behind this. And the truth is, with Fred Rogers, there really wasn't.
I would say it's just he was who he was.
Yeah. It's like finding the one good minister at your Catholic church, the one person who's bought in, you know, and is really in the business of saving souls, and making a movie about him and saying, well, there's something sinister there. He's really trying to do something else, and it rubbed me the wrong way.
I do think, though, regardless, I mean, I think that he's going to win for. I think Brad Pitt should win.
It's Brad Pitt.
You think Brad Pitt?
We'll get into that, but. Yeah.
I was going to say, Brad Pitt's my pick for it, definitely.
Brad Pitt's man boobs are taking the Oscar.
I don't know if you saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I mean.
Yeah, of course I saw once. I saw
it. I'm speaking.
Saw an opening week. Oh,
I'm speaking you.
Rhetorically.
To our listeners.
It's not being,
yeah.
Yes.
You the general you. But, oh man. I think I saw that twice. I'm pretty sure that was one of the films I saw twice in theaters. I saw that twice, and I saw. The one with the dude that I really liked. When I say the dude, I mean the dude in the Big Lebowski. Bad Times at the El Royale. I saw that twice in theaters. A lot of people didn't like that, but I loved it.
Before we break, I know what this album is, but I can't remember. Before we break.
Derek's just looking at a random CD right now, by the way. Is that the Violent Femmes? It looks like that.
No, it's something.
But that's from over here. Oh, no, it's not that.
Mark Kermode is one of the top critics in the United Kingdom. He broadcasts on BBC Five. And they post a fair amount of his stuff on the internet with his co-host, Simon Mayo. And they were doing reader mail, and someone wrote in to talk about Star Wars and Frozen 2. And this is one of the funniest things I've heard in a while. And having not seen Frozen 2, but knowing the plot from reviews and so forth, this is probably much more dead on than it should be.
Well, Frozen 2 and The Rise of Skywalker today, as they are the same film, mm-hmm. I can review them at the same time.
Okay.
A young lady learning to harness her newfound mystical power must go on a quest that will not only save herself and everyone else, but also reveal the secrets in her lineage that have been buried for decades. Initially seeking to go on her quest alone, her close-knit group refuse to allow it and insist they will accompany her on her path, but ultimately she's forced to leave them behind and face her final test alone. How's it going so far?
You're very good.
That test proves almost too much. She does learn her true and disturbing heritage, that although her parents were lovely, a rather nasty grandfather has been the source of all the bother that's been going on for the years. Nice way of putting it. While she is, well, you know, all that bother.
All that bother.
While she is able to make amends for the misdeeds of her ancestor, the girl is only able to save everyone else by sacrificing herself. Fortunately, the film is able to both have its cake and to eat that delicious cake. After delivering the emotional and dramatic gut punch of her death, she is quickly resurrected, so nobody is too sad for too long. A serviceable but unoriginal sequel with satisfying moments, some laughs, and nostalgic musical cues, clearly made by committee to maximize financial return from a franchise that's already said all it ever needed to. Tinkety-tonk, down with committees. That's Chris Holt.
That is insane. That is insane.
That was beautiful.
And having seen one of those movies, I can tell you that's exactly what that movie is.
I was going to say, that reminds me, if I forget who pointed all of this out, but the Avatar Pocahontas thing.
Yes. Yeah, that those are, in fact, the exact same movie.
Yeah.
It is WMFO Medford, Derek and Shay talking about movies. On the Tell, Mikey D coming your way in less than 10 minutes. Before that, see it, skip it, stream it.
Boom.
We'll tell you about the new movies coming up this Thursday, Wednesday, Friday, right after this here on WMFO Medford.
Lower your aerial when entering Universal Studios Car Wash.
Car Wash. A typical day in L.A. Mr. Richard Pryor is Daddy Rich.
Praise the Lord! Praise the Lord! Why don't you climb on board and believe in me? Because it's better to have money and not to need it than to need it not to have it.
Well, praise this car, honey.
Thank you, miss.
Franklin Ajay, Professor Irwin Corey, and George Carlin as the cabbie.
We will go anywhere. We are not yellow. Get it? It's no kind of a slur in the Chinese or anything like that.
Special guest, the Pointer Sisters, and a full disco soundtrack. From Universal Pictures, it's a clean movie. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
If you're a single man under the age of 35, you'd probably like to know what the ladies are looking for on an online dating site. A guy who had a few drinks and later got pulled over for buzz driving. See, that could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. And doesn't a guy who's back living with his parents but calls them my roommates just scream, Mr. Right?
Buzzed, busted, and broke. Because buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. We are wrapping things up here at the big moving picture. We'll figure it out.
Moving
I am Shay Spillane. With me, as always, Derek Gary. Before we go, we do want to tell you for the top five movies opening this week, whether we would see it, stream it, or skip it. We're going to start with Bad Boys for Life.
I want to remind everyone that this time of year used to be called Dumpuary.
Yeah, because it's like, all right, well, yeah. I'm not going to get an Oscar, so...
That was a film industry term, dumpuary. Where all of the movies that they didn't know what to do with, you just throw them out in January and hope somebody goes to see them.
Yeah.
Bad Boys, I've actually, there's four, I threw one of them out because it's a very limited release. Bad Boys for Life is a... how far Will Smith has fallen? This is a direct result of every bad starring role that Will Smith has had.
Every bad decision that Will Smith's made over the last several years.
You know, the Bad Boys movies that came out 20 years ago? Was it 20?
That is a good 20 years
ago. It's a while ago.
Like, my brother was watching those in high school.
Yeah, it's a while ago. They're great movies, you know? And it's like... Yeah, I know Lethal Weapon did the thing where they came back and they were middle-aged, and it's like, you kind of expect this.
I was going to say, that's basically what this is.
But I've seen this movie, and stream it. You know,
I was going to say, this is a stream it for me, too. It's like, I would not go and sit in the theater with this, but I see, like, next time my family gets together and it's on Netflix, me and my brother up at midnight will watch Bad Boys for Life.
You know what it is? It's a hot Saturday afternoon with a can of beer.
Yeah.
In front of the TV and the air conditioning.
Yeah.
Is what it is. Doolittle.
Doolittle. I see, this one's tricky for me because the plot sounds interesting. The cast is obviously, I mean...
The cast is ridiculous.
Like, Rami Malek, Octavia Spencer, Emma Thompson, like, John Cena, like...
Yeah.
What?
It goes on and on. You're like, how did you get this voice cast?
Yeah, like, what in the hell? That alone makes me want to see it, but the reviews have been not so favorable.
I read one review today that said, if you enjoyed Cats... you're going to enjoy Doolittle. And they basically just said the entire movie is bonkers. Like, what all of this talent is doing here, first of all, is a mystery. I've watched the trailers for this. And looking at Robert Downey Jr., the only thing that I can think of is that this film was written for Hugh Jackman. Turned it down. And they somehow got Robert Downey Jr. to do it.
I would say, like, it isn't even out yet. The tomato meter on Rotten Tomatoes has it at 12%.
Yeah, he's clearly playing Hugh Jackman in this film.
Robert Downey Jr. as Hugh Jackman as Dr. Doolittle.
I love a good train wreck, but it has to be Cats-level train wreck to get me out of the theater. I suppose if you've got kids... Oh, and by the way, apparently it's wall-to-wall fart jokes. And
like Emma Thompson. They real Antonio Banderas.
Because when you think fart jokes, you think Emma Thompson. You know, and Antonio Banderas.
Thought jokes in a British accent.
Yeah. I mean, the Shrek movies got away with it because they didn't overdo it.
And those were Scottish accents.
Yeah.
The Scots, we're a little more...
this seems to be...
A little more tongue-in-cheek.
You know, all about animals farting.
A little less, depending on how you look at it.
Robert Downey Jr. looking confused. It will be worth seeing at some point, but I'm not going to...
I was
going to
say... Like, this is a, if I'm super bored, I do have my 3-movie-a-week pass, but if this was a normal, I'm paying for this thing, I don't see myself seeing this.
I'm not giving the theater my money, so maybe you stream it, but I think you can skip it and your life will not suffer.
Is the one that you skipped the one I think you probably skipped?
Which would be?
The anime one?
No.
Really?
No.
Weathering with You?
Yes. Because
oh right, you're a Pokemon nerd.
No. This goes way beyond Pokemon.
I know which one you skipped.
Makoto Shinkai is the best feature length animator working in the world today. Whether or not you decide to go see this movie in the theater, you should see this movie. His last film, Your Name, is phenomenal. And I think it's probably available streaming somewhere. So if you don't know, go watch Your Name.
The highest grossing anime film of all time.
If you ever liked any of the Miyazaki or Studio Ghibli films, you will love Makoto Shinkai because you've got that same level of technical craftsmanship and really, really great storytelling. Highly, I would say go see this. Take the kids to see this.
See, it's a skip it for me.
Yeah.
I'm not... It's just not, and it's nothing. I'm sure it's great for people who that's their thing, but not for me. I know which one you skipped, by the way, which is Disturbing the Peace, right?
Yeah. No.
No?
No, it was the other one because it's
Intigo,
only...
Intigo, Death of an
It's
Author.
Only showing in like 10 theaters around the country.
Oh, okay. So yeah, skip that one.
Disturbing the Peace. Guy Pearce is a small town sheriff when the bikers roll into town. Devin Sawa is one of the bikers for some reason. Nope. Skip it.
Skip it.
Hard. Do not
hard
see this
Hard pass.
Movie.
Yeah.
That is all the time we have for this week. Until next time, Chase Blaine.
I love you all. Mwah.
And I am Derek Gary. Stay warm and until